All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 080419, the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio, versus Kia Bailey individually and Larry Bailey individually from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 080453, Jeffrey Klein, MD, and Baylor College of Medicine versus Cynthia Hernandez as the parent and next friend of NH, a minor from Harris County and the 1st Court of Appeals District. And docket number 080465, the State of Texas versus $281,420 in United States currency, and that's from Hidalgo County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted to the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 080419, University of Texas Health Science Center versus Kia Bailey and Larry Bailey.
May it please the court, Mr. Murphy will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Court of Appeals incorrectly held that plaintiff's claim was not time barred due to the relation back doctrine in section 101-106F. This court should reverse and dismiss plaintiff's claim because it is barred by the Medical Liability Act's strict 2-year statute of limitations. Neither the relate back doctrine nor section 101-106F excuses plaintiff's untimely filing. To begin with, plaintiff's claim is barred because they didn't sue the university until after the limitations period on their claim had expired. Section 74.251 imposes a strict 2-year limitations period to bring medical liability claims that applies notwithstanding any other law. Because plaintiffs didn't sue UT until after the limitations period expired, their claim is now barred and the university has a vested right to rely on the statute of limitations as a defense. It is plaintiff's duty, not the university's.
Mr. Murphy, is it your position that if the relation back doctrine had been codified, if it were part of 101.106F or part of 101.106, that 74.251 would still act as a bar to prohibit?
That's right, Justice Willett. 74.251 applies notwithstanding any other law, and this court has held that that phrase means that it applies over any conflicting statute. But the relate back doctrine only applies to timely filed claims against defendants that were added within the limitations period. This court has long held that the relate back doctrine does not apply when new defendants are added after limitations periods expire.
But they're not really a new defendant, are they? I mean, the theory is respondeat superior. That's the whole basis of the substitution in.
No, they are. The university is a new defendant just because they sued Dr. Sanders personally. Dr. Sanders, in official capacity, is an entirely different entity. It's the university. Because an official capacity suit is a suit to recover from the university, not from Dr. Sanders personally.
What is this vested right that you're talking about? You said the university has a vested right.
It has a vested right to rely on the statute of limitations as a defense. And that advances the society's interest in repose. This 101-106F, even if it were an exception to the statute of limitations generally, would not apply here because of the notwithstanding any other law phrase in 74.251. And the Court of Appeals decision excusing that untimely filing violates the plain language of 74.251, and it also violates the university's vested right. When plaintiff substituted the university, as I mentioned, Dr. Sanders, they added a new defendant. And adding a new defendant after limitations does not relate back to the original petition. Section 101-106F is simply not an exception to the statute of limitations, and it does not convert a personal capacity claim into an official capacity claim. Subsection F is a tort restriction, not a claim preserver. Although the provision is not a model of clarity, and it does impose a stiff restriction on plaintiff's claims, the only reasonable interpretation of the provision is that it applies subject to other procedural requirements, not as an exception to them.
I haven't seen the petition, but I assume that when the plaintiff sued the doctor, it said individually.
No capacity was stated, Chief Justice Jefferson, but the clear intent was to sue him personally. There's no dispute about that. And in fact, they fought the 101-106F motion of Dr. Sanders because they continued to want to seek recovery from him personally. They eventually lost in the Court of Appeals and decided not to file a PFR. But
was the UT Health Science Center mentioned at all in the?
They were not mentioned. They were not served. No official capacity was stated. The Tort Claims Act was not mentioned. The university was not served with an expert report. They were not served with notice under the Tort Claims Act as required, or under the Medical Liability Act as required.
But did they have any actual notice?
There's no actual notice in this case. Notice is irrelevant here.
Maybe not irrelevant. But did the university have any report? It seemed like I recall from the briefing that maybe the doctor said this was not a good result and something may have happened.
Justice Johnson, that's correct. Dr. Sanders notified the risk manager merely that the procedure did not go as intended and that a claim may be filed against him. But as this court...
And that was when?
That was soon after, within I think probably a week or two of the surgery. But as this court held in Simons, actual notice requires actual subjective knowledge of fault. Dr. Sanders' notice to the risk manager doesn't come anywhere near that level of knowledge.
And it's not in the briefing. That's not the question presented, right. I understand. But the fact that the university was aware of the incident may have something to do with whether or not it's unfair to bring them in at this point.
Well, it's not unfair because plaintiffs exclusively sought recovery from Dr. Sanders personally. They only wanted to recover from him. So the university had no incentive or notice to prepare a defense. And that's the point of statutes of limitations is.
Of course, he didn't get sued immediately after. It took a while, but both he and the university apparently knew that things did not go exactly as maybe he had planned in the surgery, and knew that immediately.
That's correct, but they didn't sue the university. They sued Dr. Sanders.
Does the record show how Dr. Sanders came to have the lawyer, or who retained the lawyer for him? Was it did he hire with personal funds or whatever?
It's my understanding that he did. The record is not entirely clear about where the money came from. But it is clear that he did not serve, he did not seek defense from the Attorney General. He didn't serve or forward the pleadings received by the plaintiff to the Attorney General's office within 10 days. And the plaintiffs didn't serve the Attorney General's office either.
Okay, so doesn't this create kind of a gotcha? I mean, all the individual has to do, and let's presume he was sued individually. All the defendant has to do is just wait till the 1 year passes and then try to substitute in. And that doesn't seem fair.
Well, the purpose of the election of remedies section is to force plaintiffs at the outset to decide.
At the outset, but for the defendants too at the outset, if they don't feel like they're properly sued, to substitute in the proper party.
Well, there is definitely a natural incentive for an employee to want to get out of the suit. I think this is an anomaly case for sure. But there's no time limit in 101-106F.
Sam, but it probably won't be an anomaly if we adopt your position. There'd be no reason. I mean, the doctor could then get together with the government entity and say, wait and file until a year's passed, and then nobody's liable.
Well, the statute doesn't prohibit that. However, the employee would still have to prove that the claim could have been brought against the government entity. So if the plaintiff had correctly sued the employee, they'd have nothing to worry about. However, if they could have sued the unit, the governmental unit, then they should have at the outset, as 101-106 clearly warns. I mean, 101-106F provides a clear warning. It does provide very stiff and irrevocable consequences to plaintiffs, but it does provide warning to them that they have to make a decision right up front that that's going to stick with them throughout the litigation.
The respondent says that the Lovato case supports their position. What's your response?
Austin Nursing versus Lovato does not apply, Chief Justice Jefferson, because it concerned a defect in capacity where the parties did not change in that case. The plaintiff merely sued in a capacity that she did not yet have and later corrected that. There's a couple of distinctions. First, the defendant never changed, and the parties in substance never changed. It's merely her correcting her her pleadings to reflect her capacity.
But the records show why 13 months went by before Dr. Sanders sought substitution or dismissal.
It doesn't, Justice Willett. It's unclear why that happened. I mean, I think this is possibly a case of truth is stranger than fiction, because under normal circumstances, employees would naturally have an incentive to get out right away rather than defend the claim themselves.
Although it wouldn't be unreasonable to expect that a defendant by its strategy would want to wait till after the limitations has passed before moving for dismissal. Nothing in the statute precludes it or requires it.
That's right. Nothing in the statute puts a time limit on a 101-106F dismissal motion. But the point there is that it forces the plaintiffs to carefully consider who to sue. And it also forces and encourages plaintiffs, if they could have sued the governmental unit, to actually sue the governmental unit, because the reality is employees could wait until after limitations expired. But there are other procedural requirements.
So, counsel, let me jump in here. So would your textual argument be that the legislature wanted plaintiffs to be careful in this area, tread very carefully, and in light of the statutory mandates. But if there's a mistake made, that it's open-ended as to when defendants can raise that mistake. That was the legislative intent, or perhaps an oversight.
Well, I think the legislature viewed this as not a mistake, but as trying to curtail creative pleading to avoid damages gaps.
Not requiring a time limit for raising the motion to dismiss and allowing it to be raised after the limitations, perhaps, which is why we're here today.
Well, I would I'm sorry.
That back end issue is either intended or unintended.
I think it was probably unintended, because the legislature probably expected employees with a natural incentive to file their claim, file their dismissal motion right away. But I think by not creating a time limit, it also creates a real warning to plaintiffs that this could happen. And it's a sobering reminder that they have to carefully consider who to sue. And if they can't sue the governmental unit, they should. I mean, 101, 106A and E both impose very strict limitations on.
If the defendant had not filed a motion to dismiss in this case, and the evidence showed that he was in the course and scope of employment with the UT Health Science Center, then the case would be a pure respondeat superior liability case, correct?
If the doctor never filed a 101-106F motion, then it would be just a pure, negligence case that he could theoretically be subject to liability for.
Yeah, but he could also, who would ultimately have to pay a judgment? I mean, would it be if he were in the course and scope and there's a finding against him, mm-hmm. Having practiced medicine within the course and scope and committing malpractice, assume the jury finds those facts, who is liable for that judgment?
Well, it would be him because he didn't invoke 104.005, which is which permits employees sued personally to be defended by the state and to be indemnified by the state.
So he would waive indemnity if he didn't pursue 104?
That's right. He had to file within 10 days, or forward within 10 days, the pleadings to the Attorney General. But that's not the case here. I mean, the case here is that he figured out that he should have filed this 101-106F motion, and he did. And the trial court and the Court of Appeals concluded that the claim could have been brought against the university. And that reveals that the plaintiffs should have initially sued the university.
This is not your case either, but what if the judge had not ruled within 30 days? He got pretty close here.
If the judge had not ruled within 30 days, then they would be barred by 101-106F.
So your reading of F is that the plaintiff has to make an election within 30 days whether the judge rules or not.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, there are ways to speed up the hearing and the ruling. But yes, they have to decide right away. And they can always appeal the Court of Appeals or the trial court's order, as happened in this case.
What's your make of the trial judge's ruling that the plaintiff sued against defendant Sanders, M.D., is in defendant Sanders' official capacity only as an employee of UT Health Sciences Center at the trial court?
I believe that's just, the trial court is just basically copying the language of 101-106F, which has in its first sentence the phrase considered to be an official capacity claim. It's just a reflection that the plaintiffs could have filed an official capacity claim, and now they must, because of the employee, Dr. Sanders' motion, they must seek recovery exclusively from the university.
Now the ruling, according to the briefing, is in response to an objection to an exhibit, but it sounds like a factual determination by the judge.
That could have been brought up. My time is up.
Thank you, counsel. The court will now hear from the respondents.
The court, Mr. Aldis will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. First of all, I want to say that I'm proud to stand up here representing the fine young woman, Kia Bailey, before you. Sometimes I forget why I'm here, but I'm trying to make sure I keep her in mind, because every time my 16-year-old son does something that makes me cringe, I just think about the things she's been through, and it makes me feel better. The couple of questions that y'all have asked, and let me just set this out. I think it clearly was a strategy on behalf of the defendants in this case to file the motion to 101-106F after limitations ran. First of all, I can say this because the trial counsel for Dr. Sanders was actually had already had an appeal related to this very issue before the San Antonio Court of Appeals, Franca versus Velasquez, 2006 Westlaw 2546535, cited in one of my footnotes. So she was entirely familiar with the issue and brought it up. And if you will look, the statute of limitations ran on June 30th, 2006, which happens to be the exact day that the administrator for the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio signed his affidavit stating that Dr. Sanders was in the course and scope of his employment at the time of this surgery.
Of course, there's no reason they shouldn't do that if that's a trial strategy and they're allowed to do it, correct?
Well, I would say typically this court has not allowed people to use the statute of limitations in such a way that it deprives someone unreasonably of a cause of action.
Yeah,
in 19
Let me ask this question. Is there any evidence in the record about insurance coverage in this case?
There is not. Let me just say that in Rook versus Jensen, which Justice Jefferson cited in the Lovato case, which was a per curiam opinion from this court, the statute of limitations was not created to provide a log behind which opportunistic defendants could smugly lay for 2 years and then emerge solemnly proclaiming their statutory rights. That's what I was referring to when I said this court usually does not look upon these matters in such a way that you can use it in the way that the defendants have used it in this case.
So if defendants make a mistake and overlook that their strategy is going to be effective, that's okay. But if they plan it, it's not okay. Is that what you're arguing?
No. What I'm arguing is that in this case, I can actually act like I have the high ground when maybe it wouldn't be that way if I didn't.
Why is June 30 the limitations date? I mean, the surgery was April 15.
The 75-day notice period extends limitations until that date.
Gotcha.
Let me ask a question. When you request the records for and before you file your lawsuit and you get the records, is there what level of difficulty is there in determining whether this doctor was in the course of employment or not? And I guess your case was filed plenty, but what if someone files a month before the limitations runs? Can you find out truly? And
it's an interesting proposition in this case. As you know, or you may know, my law firm was not the law firm that filed the original petition. However, Dr. Sanders accepted his appointment approximately 3 weeks prior to the time he performed this surgery. He performed the surgery at Christ at Santa Rosa Hospital, which is not the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. In fact, his records in his file still used his old firm, the Texas Orthopedic whatever, as his letterhead. So there was no outward indication on the records that this surgery was done while he was appointed to the University of Texas. Subsequently, in fact, the only time there was an amended answer filed in this case that asserted a indemnity provision that is set forth in or requested it said this case is brought under Chapter 74 and also under 101, but it made no real reference to the fact that he was actually working for University of Texas at the time. It wasn't until August 25th that that allegation actually came out. August 25th, 2006.
But the ability of the plaintiff's attorney to find out whether the doctor was working for, who the doctor was working for, that was my question.
Typically, it is an easy proposition.
It is or is not?
It is. In this case, it was not. And it's simply because of the timing of the issues.
Does F change the rule in Kasson?
Yes. Let me address this. First of all, I think we can all agree that the relation back doctrine does not offend the absolute 2-year statute of limitations found in 74.251. And the reason I say that is if you look at 74.251, and actually it says, no health care liability claim may be commenced unless the action is filed within 2 years from the occurrence. Now, the only case that I could find that was actually directly on point was an appeal from a young trial judge in Dallas named Nathan Hecht of Bradley versus Esteman, where summary judgment was granted because they filed an amended petition after the limitations, and the judge said, you can't do that. The Court of Appeals said, no, that's not right. Relation back does work because an action is a suit, and you satisfy the limitations by filing the action within 2 years. Anything that amends it to with regard to causes of action or facts later on is not offensive of it. And Justice Green, in the Jordan, N. Ray Jordan case, you went through a lot of trouble to distinguish causes of action versus a suit. And you said causes of actions are based on facts.
But so, we have also said that you can't relate back to pulling a new defendant.
True. But
and that seems to be the argument. That
that's right.
But individually, and you're bringing in now official capacity.
And as I understood their briefing, they disputed even that relation back was appropriate under with regard to 74.251. Once we accept that relation back works, then the question is, how, can this my amended petition, which as UT, relate back to the one that filed against Dr. Sanders? And I'd say yes, because the legislative intent from Section F is clear. It says, suit filed against an employee of a governmental unit based on conduct within the general scope of that employee's employment, and if it could have been brought under this chapter against the governmental unit, the suit is considered to be against the employee in the employee's official capacity only.
So that changes the rule in Kasson, do you think?
That what that does is it says that you, the court now considers, the legislature has said, you now consider that that employee is being sued in his official capacity only.
Because Kasson would have said the opposite.
I believe so.
So this is a fairly significant change because Kasson said, well, doctors are not like a lot of government employees who are not professional people who go about their jobs and they're generally in the course of employment and that's their official capacity. But a doctor, when he's exercising medical discretion as opposed to some sort of administrative governmental discretion, is in his individual capacity, not in his governmental capacity. Therefore, he doesn't have official immunity. And so I'm wondering if this changes that rule.
Well, let me just say this. I believe that the legislature gave us no intent in this statute that it intended to take away a citizen's common law right cause of action against a state employee individual.
But there was intent that plaintiffs act carefully and choose their defendant carefully and do a careful investigation pre-lawsuit.
Well, it not necessarily. And let me say it this way. You have two careful decisions to make. One is proceed against the employee alone or proceed against the state entity under the Tort Claims Act. That's the question you ask. So what you have to decide is, can I bring this, if I'm going to sue the government only, is it something that I can recover under the Tort Claims Act? Because actually the liability of an individual is broader. It covers things that are not just from the use of tangible personal property. For instance, if I would have alleged in this case that he gave a bad prescription, then that would not be something that would be under the Tort Claims Act, and it would have been a suit that was just individually. And I think it was Justice Jefferson who asked earlier, what would have happened in this case if the employee had never filed 101-106F motion? And the answer to that question is a judgment, if it would have been rendered, would have been rendered against the doctor. However, the Tort Claims Act gives certain protections to an employee. It limits the damages to $100,000 and gives that employee a right of indemnity back against the state institution. For them to argue and to say to you that the hospital had nothing to do with this and the hospital was unfairly left out of the loop is just ignores the reality of the situation.
Counsel said that right would have been waived because there was no effort to notify the Attorney General within 10 days.
Well, there certainly is no statute that says that it would be waived, perhaps pursuant to the rules, regulations, or the Office of the Attorney General. They may say it had been waived, but the statute clearly says that an employee acting within the course and scope of his employment who's being sued is entitled to indemnity, and that's in 104.003 and 108.002. Now, I think that the common law right of action still exists. But what this section does...
Well, I'm not sure I know what that means, though.
All right.
It seems to say that when you're saying, in this case, a physician, although not limited to that, if he's acting in the general scope of employment, then that's in his official capacity and you have to sue the government.
If he files the motion.
Yes. But curiously... it doesn't require the judge to rule. It seems to put the plaintiff to an election whether the judge rules or not.
Well,
that's why I asked petitioner, what happens after 30, what if the judge doesn't rule in 30 days? Here he ruled pretty close to the end.
Yeah, I was feeling that pressure because there was a case out of, I think, Corpus Christi that said, or Beaumont, that said that if you wait till after the 30 days, you've waived your right. There is one case that says that.
Well, there's another case where the plaintiff went ahead and dropped the physician or the employee and added the government, and then decided he wanted to go back the other way, and said, well, you can't do that.
Yes, that's why in this particular case, once the motion was filed, I asked for it to be set for hearing because I knew about the case. So I asked for it to be set for hearing as soon as I could. It was actually heard and the judge ruled, and I filed the amended petition the day of the 30 days passing, although I did it by mail, but it still was accepted.
So it was filed the next day, but it was done by mail, so that's why it was timed. But you do think, like the petitioner does, that if the trial judge doesn't rule in 30 days, the plaintiff still has to make the election?
I can't imagine that being the rule, simply because the judge does have to find that the case could have been brought under the statute, under the Tort Claims Act. So if I had a situation where I'd sued the doctor for a common law claim, and the common law claim was, for instance, you know, he gave me a bad prescription, which is not the tangible or the use of tangible personal property, and the state or the employee filed the motion, what this would seem to say is that I have to basically figure out for myself whether or not the judge is going to decide that it could have been brought under the Tort Claims Act or not. Now, truthfully, that's what it says. Does it make sense? Not necessarily. You should be able to, it should say 30 days after the court rules.
But it
sure doesn't. And I can't really change it, despite all my years in the legislature. let me say, once legislature said the suit is considered to be against the employee in the employee's official capacity only, what that means is it puts it squarely in Lovato, the Austin Nursing Center case. Because what you said was curing capacity, fixing capacity, changing capacity when everybody has no, that relates back. And that was a case, a medical malpractice case. And what this ends up saying is the legislature said what we're going to do is we're going to change his capacity. Now, we all have to assume the legislature knows the law. And as this court is well aware, suit against an official in his official capacity is the same as suit against the state.
And it would be a suit in his official capacity no matter what the plaintiff's allegations were, correct?
Irrespective of whether or not capacity was alleged in the petition.
Well, what I'm saying is, in this case, it was a suit against the doctor in his individual capacity.
Yeah.
And 101-106F says, if it could have been brought against a governmental entity and is within the general scope of employment, then it is deemed to be a suit against the doctor in his official capacity, no matter what the petition says.
Exactly. And as a result, so this actually makes sense then, because what you see is the legislature saying, if you could have brought this case under the Tort Claims Act, we're going to give the employee an opportunity to get out. Now, the reason that, to me, why that is what is shown by the intent is because if the legislature intended to take away a cause of action that a plaintiff had, it would have simply said, the case is dismissed, not that you substitute in the governmental unit. And I assume that, as we all have to, that the legislature knows the law, and they know that a case against an official in his official capacity is, in fact, a suit against the state, so that it would relate back to the original petition. As the Court of Appeals said, you know, the facts, the plaintiff, and all the claims have never changed. The only thing that's changed is now UT is standing in the shoes of Dr. Sanders, its employee. Its employee filed the motion. Its employee was fully, the hospital was fully aware of the case, was fully aware of the claims. In fact, the university entered into a Rule 11 agreement with me when I filed a motion for summary judgment to get all these issues satisfied. One of my grounds for my motion for summary judgment was that the statute of limitations was, it did relate back. The University of Texas Health Science Center entered into a Rule 11 agreement with me agreeing that it would not assert a notice defense in this case. And that's at page 544 of the record. I think that if the legislature was going to intend to allow a defendant to take away their right, it would have done so expressly rather than through the 101-106F that we have here.
Tell me about this Rule 11 agreement again. Can you go back and talk about this Rule 11 agreement and what bearing and weight should we give that, if any?
One of the grounds for me opposing the motion of the doctor when he wanted to switch in UT is I said, well, what if UT raises a limitations defense?
When was this in the chronology of everything?
It was after, it was at the hearing on the doctor's motion to substitute. So it would have been in September August of 2006. I said, you know, it says that you have to be able to bring it under the Tort Claims Act, and what if the hospital says that or doesn't consent? And the judge said, well, tough luck. And so entered the order anyway. But as part of that, I filed a motion for summary judgment saying, trying to clear the grounds for all of what the hospital or UT would have known. In other words, I filed a motion for summary judgment that they had notice, actual notice. I filed a motion for summary judgment saying that it did involve the use of tangible personal property, and the other grounds that the only thing that I didn't file it on was the actual negligence of the doctor. In response to that, trial counsel for the University of Texas entered into a Rule 11 agreement with me, agreeing with all of that motion except the limitations defense. So
and
basically,
this was after limitations had run anyway, correct?
Well, that's the allegation. But the timing had clearly run. But this is at page 544 of the record. So basically, by entering into that Rule 11 agreement, it left the only thing for us to argue on competing motions for summary judgment, the limitations issue. In Texas A&M versus Cossey something, Oglu, Justice Green wrote the opinion. You know, it involved whether or not the employee in his official capacity could appeal, interlocutory appeal, from a denial of or granting of a
plea of the jurisdiction.
In that case, you actually said, I don't believe the legislature could intend to treat an official in his official capacity different from the government when we know what the law is. And I submit to you that it's the same here. It's the same here in that we know that an official in his official capacity is the same thing as a state. Once the statute says they're the same, then it relates back. In addition, they cannot rely on the fact that they didn't consent because as Justice O'Neill, as you said in the Mission ISD versus Garcia case, the legislature is the one who determines when consent is given by the state. And 101-106F actually gives consent to add the university as the party.
Counsel, I see that your time has expired. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you very much.
Just a few points. First, the phrase considered to be in section 101-106F simply means that if the preceding conditions are satisfied, the plaintiff could have filed an official capacity claim. That's all it means. And that opens the door to the plaintiff's, to the employee's ability to file a dismissal motion. Second, 101-106F does not convert a claim as respondents allege here. If it did, the dismissal and substitution requirements in the second sentence of 101-106F would be entirely superfluous because the defendant would, the entity would already be the defendant. It would also constitute a massive end run around a number of procedural requirements, including limitations, pre-suit notice, and expert report filing requirements. Additionally, the Austin Nursing versus Lovato case that respondents rely upon is just a defect in capacity claim. The parties never changed. It was merely a plaintiff correcting a capacity that she did not yet have. In this case, the difference between a personal capacity suit and a official capacity suit is the difference between the governmental unit and an employee personally. Finally, on the notice issue, notice really is irrelevant here. UT did not have notice under Simons, but even if it did, the only notice it had was of a claim against another defendant, Dr. Sanders personally. It was never served with suit. It was never notified that a claim was filed against it until after limitations had run.
If the statute simply said it determined that the employee was acting in the course of employment and the was in his official capacity, the suit against the employee must be dismissed. Don't we get the same situation?
That would be very similar to 101-106A's strict requirement of prohibiting suits against employees once the employer, the governmental unit, was sued. 101-106F has a relatively modest 30-day window for plaintiffs to substitute the unit.
It's effectively requiring the dismissal of the suit against the employee.
That's right.
So what is the meaning of the rest of this? What's the meaning of the rest of the language in that section? We're first saying you have to dismiss if it's an official capacity suit.
Well,
it seems like the rest of the language that you're substituting for has to mean something, because you could dismiss and then sue. If you dismiss against the employee, he could promptly file suit against the employer, against the state.
No, you couldn't do that because 101-106B prohibits exactly that.
Okay.
The point of the substitution is that, as I said, it's a very modest accommodation to plaintiffs. If, for example, the 101-106F motion was filed very early on, before other procedural requirements had run and before limitations had run, then yeah, they could add the government.
What about opposing counsel's focus in 74-251 on the may be commenced language?
I think that's just kind of a red herring. I mean, the court clearly has held that adding a new defendant, which the university clearly was here, does not relate back to a plaintiff's original petition. That's the case here. Therefore, the limitations period in 74.251 expired and entirely bars their claim against the university. Although the result in this case may seem harsh, it is no more so than the consequences imposed by 101-106A or E, which forbids any claim against an employee, regardless of the merits, when the governmental unit is sued. The court should reverse the Court of Appeals and dismiss this claim as time barred.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Murphy. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.